Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. As we race toward the end of 2017, let's take a moment to look back at the year in sports in Boston and beyond. There were big games and big wins for local teams, but so much of the sports world collided with social issues and politics this year. So joining me now is Bob Ryan, a longtime colleague at the Boston Globe. Now, Bob, I know you like to refer to yourself as a Boston Globe sports columnist emeritus, but we can still read your columns regularly in the Globe on Sundays, and we can hear you wax poetic about sports as host of Bob Ryan's Boston podcast. Bob, thank you for joining me in the studio
today. Oh, it's great to see you again, Shira.
Likewise. So let's start with what was probably the highlight for many Boston fans this year, when the Patriots won their seventh Super Bowl championship in Houston last February. I was on hand for that game. They came back. It was a historic comeback victory. They came back from a 28-3 deficit in the second half. Here's some sound from that game.
Ooh. Toss to White. He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth! What a comeback!
That last touchdown right on the line of the end zone. You've seen a lot of big moments in sports, big wins. So where does this Super Bowl victory rank?
The problem is that
the
trauma and ranking.
Yeah.
These Patriots, seven Super Bowls in the Brady Belichick era. They have won five, they have lost two. Every game was competitive. Every game was decided late. It could be 0-7 without any problem. They could be 7-0, and they're 5-2. The drama in this one, it is the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history. The number combination 28-3 are not going to be popular, locker room combinations on your locker, in Atlanta. They're already being taunted, by other people during the course of this football season with people holding up signs and such when the Falcons play.
Yeah, it's become sort of a shorthand,
28-3,
right?
28-3. People are going to go to their graves, with the most least popular combination of numbers in Atlanta will be 28-3. Of course it was spectacular. And they looked like they had no chance of stopping Atlanta in the beginning, but we are so used now to the spectacular, to the unpredictable, to the drama that Brady and company had generate, and consider their last two Super Bowl victories, that traumatic losses, wonderful exhilarating wins, but maybe even bigger to the world at large. I don't think the Seahawks have ever gotten over what happened at the end of that game. Truly, they've not come back. And Atlanta seemed to have a horrible hangover at the beginning of the year. They did rebound later on. But of course, it was exhilarating. But I'll say this. The one in Seattle was even more startling. I got to tell a very quick story now. I know it's 2 years ago. But I'm sitting with a bunch of people at home watching the game. And here it goes. Marshawn Lynch gets down to 1 yard line. You know the game's over. You know it's going in. And here all of a sudden, he's passing. Then it's, who's Malcolm Butler? I had no idea. So that moment jumps out at me a little bit ahead of what happened last year.
So you mentioned Atlanta's Super Bowl hangover this year. The Patriots got off to a bit of a shaky start. This was a team that everybody in the preseason had sort of predicted undefeated.
Some people talking undefeated.
Exactly. And now, it was a loss in the season opener when they hung the banner or unveiled the banner.
Yeah.
Now look where we are. Is there any surprise that this is where this team is?
They take punches in the mouth and shrug them off and come back and go about their business better than any team in professional sport. That was a punch in the mouth. Kansas City ran all over them. They didn't appear to have any hope of stopping them defensively. And their defense was, in fact, a mess. Even the next week they come back, they win 36-20. They give up a lot of yards, but not a lot of points. That's been the theme this year, by the way. They give up yards, but they don't give up points. They're very good inside the hallowed red zone. How about Buffalo in 120 minutes of football did not get a touchdown, offensive touchdown, against the Patriots? They fixed some of that problem on defense and come around, and it's just another sensational year for the Patriots.
Where it looks like they're headed right back to the Super Bowl.
They have a very good chance.
Of course, in Minneapolis, of all places, which will be another interesting story in 2018. But I think one of the real big stories in the NFL this year was not only what happened on the game, but what happened on the sidelines. Correct. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. The protests that were inspired by what Colin Kaepernick did, gosh, a season ago, you know, with the kneeling during the national anthem and protesting racial inequality. And also, you know, we can tie it into the Super Bowl with the Patriots because, you know, there were several Patriots who mm-hmm. declined to go to the White House.
Yes.
So what do you make of what has happened with the protest movement in the NFL?
I underestimated the scope of it in terms of its deleterious effect on attendance and interest in the league. I poo-pooed it, but I think so. There's been some evidence that it has had a negative effect on the league. That there are a surprising number of white fans who have turned this into a something completely opposite, but away from what it originally intended to be. You know, they've made this into a litmus test on loyalty and patriotism and the military, a referendum on your love for the military, which is that not what was farthest thing from Colin Kaepernick's mind when he took the knee originally a year ago. And it's been his whole point has been hijacked in a sense, you know.
And I was going to say, is part of the reason it's been hijacked in a sense because, you know, early this season, Trump, you know, President Trump sort of stoked the fires. And we can actually hear what President Trump said that may have gotten fans more riled up.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired.
At the time he did that, the flame was going out.
Yes.
I truly believe, and I'm not alone in this thought, that it would have died a very quiet and peaceful death, and things would have gone along very nicely had POTUS not injected himself that night in Alabama into this discussion. There is no question in my mind that he stoked, that he created what was, that was the match in the gas tank, whatever, and that was it for the 2018. Absolutely, I believe that.
So let's turn to other moments where sort of racial inequality or racial incidents were addressed. Again, this collision of politics and sports this year, which was such a big theme. We have to go to Fenway, and we have to go to the Adam Jones incident in May. Just to remind listeners, Jones played for the Baltimore Orioles, and while he was at Fenway during a game, he said he was called the N-word and hit with a bag of peanuts. Then the next night, a fan referred to a Kenyan woman who was singing the national anthem with a racial slur. That fan, to the Red Sox credit, was banned for life mm-hmm. from Fenway Park. And then in September, you had protesters unfurl a banner over the Green Monster that read, "Racism is as American as baseball." I mean, it was a really wild year, but in some respects, though, in many respects, Fenway and the Red Sox are no stranger to these types
well, the
of
problem,
racial
and,
incidents
again,
given their history.
Boston has an unfortunate history and reputation.
We always reference Pumpsy Green Jackie Robinson tribe at this
well
point.
Earned, yeah. Well earned over the previous decades. And I do think things are much better. I think we can cite chapter and verse about this athlete and that athlete being quite popular amongst people of all colors in Boston. But it would be very naive of any white person to think that racism is extinct. It's ridiculous. And things like this remind you that it is not extinct, that racism is still part of the fabric of not just Boston, but America. And though things are better, and they are, they're not perfect, and they're far from perfect. If this happened in any other city, it wouldn't have gotten the attention it got because there goes Boston. It's back to and people here have to learn to live. We have had to learn to live with this reputation. I thought we were doing better. What's the percentage of that we're talking about? I don't know. I don't know what the percentage is. By the way, there are people who are trying to say that it never happened. I don't know what the truth is, whether it happened or it didn't happen. But the fact is that people believe it happened, and that's all that matters.
How did you feel about the Red Sox response to all this? I mean, the ban for life, and then they organized this Take the Lead initiative where they're going to try to, you know, make Fenway more open to create jobs for minority.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. Residents. I mean, I just, you know, when you go to Fenway, and I do, honest to God, I do this sometimes. God, as you know, I'm a season ticket holder. And I'll sit there every night, not every night, some nights, and look around just trying to see, do I see a black face? You know, I don't think that I think that large swaths of the local black community just inherently eliminate Fenway from the night out or day out because they don't feel comfortable.
Do you think that'll change with Alex Cora as the manager?
Oh, I hope that would be – it's a good step forward. I don't know how much direct effect
first, something – We should mention the first Hispanic manager.
He's a Puerto Rican who went to college in America at Mayor's Bay, Miami. Is wonderfully bilingual. I mean, his English is impeccable. He's going to bring a different flavor to the whole enterprise. I think it's a wonderful idea. I was lobbied for him as much as I could, in the sense, you know, with my tweets and stuff from the beginning. I'm happy he got the job. I don't know if this is going to have a direct effect, but I mean, this transcends sports, obviously, but it's connected, as you said, they're connected, and Boston, for this to happen in Boston, you know, was discouraging, and it is a setback, because I do think some progress have been made in this regard in Boston. We're a long way from, you know, the Bill Russell era when someone broke into his house and smeared feces on his wall. But are we as far away as we want to be? Not yet.
You bring up Bill Russell and the Celtics. Let's turn to the Celtics, but in a different vein. This was supposed to be the big year for the Celtics, and then Gordon Hayward.
5 minutes.
I know, 5 minutes. Gruesome leg injury, first quarter of the season opener in Cleveland, and it was panic, all is lost. And then wait, hold on. Fast forward to today, the Celtics are the top team in the Eastern Conference. They had a near record-breaking winning streak, and they are doing this without Gordon Hayward, who there seems like there might be a slight chance of him returning before the end of the season. So should we be surprised, or is this, you know, what you would expect from Kyrie Irving, you know, also a new acquisition, and mastermind Brad Stevens, the coach?
I wasn't expecting anything as dramatic as a 16-game winning streak. And I do think what we're seeing now, as they have struggled over the last 21 games and with a 500-ish record, is a little bit of a market correction, okay? That was a wonderful streak. It gave them a good cushion for the rest of the season. They still have deficiencies. But they're on the right path. Mm-hmm. They're on the right path. The great thing about this team is the youth factor. The reigning player in point of service is 23 years old. That is Marcus Smart. That the star of the team is 25.
Jason Tatum
is 19 years old.
It's crazy.
And he plays, you know,
plays like a 25-year-old, right? Like a six- or seven-year veteran.
Positively. In fact, the last Celtic rookie that had this kind of and young player had this kind of poise was McHale, who struck me as a second year, that he'd been like a 10-year veteran. This kid is uncommonly poised, and he's immensely gifted. And next year, here comes Hayward, you know. And so there, whatever happens this year, I don't think they're going to win a championship. Cleveland's going to get better and better, and Cleveland will make a move, I promise you. The Celtics may make a move also. They have an $8 million so-called exception that they can exercise up to February, and they may very well find a shooter that they need to help them. But the future, they're in good shape.
So we've gone from a year in review to a crystal ball outlook.
All right, but let's go back the year. Let's pay homage to a wonderful figure that I hope will never be forgotten in the history of Boston sports.
Isaiah Thomas.
Absolutely.
Right? Yes.
What Isaiah Thomas did and accomplished here should never be forgotten. And I don't like the
affinity he had for the city, which was so poignant, and playing after his sister died in the car. I mean, there was probably no more emotion. I mean, more off the field moment, in the sense that it happened off the field, but that was probably an emotional high, you know, in terms of the respect the crowd showed when he came back and played, you know, days after. I think it was a day and a half after the news of his sister's death.
It was so much fun to watch, and I marveled at his skill and how many times he would go to the basket and I'd say, oh, this one's going down his esophagus, and he would find a way to spin it up off the glass with his right hand, maybe, or he's left-handed, and he had one of the great offhands I've ever seen. Yeah, I don't like the way it ended. I don't like the fact that, you know, he feels bitter. He does. He feels that Danny, you know, he didn't like when
Danny
admitted that part of the reason he traded him was the bad hip. I don't wish Danny had never said that. Let's not forget what he did.
Yes, and as someone who's 5'2", I got to embrace the little guys on the court. So I want to, though, turn to women in sports.
Yes.
Which is, you know, is a topic close to my heart and that I care very deeply about. And I think for me, one of the standout stories was, again, that intersection of politics and sports, was the U.S. women's national hockey team threatening to boycott the 2017 World Hockey Championships, which were going to take place and did take place in Michigan, so a home championship. And they were doing it because basically they wanted more respect. They wanted to close the pay gap between what they earned and what the men's team earned. And in addition to that, they wanted better travel accommodations. Yeah. They wanted better development, support for development programs for young girls who wanted to play hockey. And they got what they wanted. Mm. You know, in a new four-year deal, they got it.
There were two sports where American women are better in the context of their world than their male counterparts. And one is hockey and one is soccer. And they have brought great glory to America throughout the world with their exploits. And they deserved everything that they asked for, and I'm so happy that they got it. I mean, they are – so I'm all for it. I absolutely. And you know, having been privileged to cover the Olympics and cover goes far back as 98, discovering a wonderful young player who just blew me away named Angela Ruggiero, who's mm-hmm. now become, you know, the doyen of American – you know, she's a IOC – is she a member?
She's an IOC member.
I mean, but I remember seeing her coming out of prep school. I could not believe this poise, this astonishing poise in Nagano in 98. She blew me away, Angela Ruggiero. And so, anyway, I know how many, you know, how good we are. So that was
And the sacrifices that these women make because they don't make the $1 million salaries the NHL players, and they don't have that opportunity.
No, and I mean, America should pay, you know, more people should pay attention to what they have given the sports world.
So I want to turn also to another topic that involved women in sports, and it was sort of where the Me Too movement intersected with sports, and that was the trial of former USA gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, and he had abused more than 100 of the young women who competed throughout the US gymnastics ranks. And, you know, he has a 60-year jail sentence.
That ought to take care of my hope.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, and what was so interesting to me was how brave these young women were to speak out. And not just, you know, average every, you know, athletes. Some of these were Olympic athletes. Like, for instance.
Well, our own Allie Raisman.
Yes, I was going to say. And we can hear Allie Raisman talk about that experience.
I don't even still have words because it's horrifying, you know, going inside. And I told my mom right away, and we kind of started talking about it. And I realized, oh my gosh, he molested me. It's a very uncomfortable and disgusting feeling. And then after that, you know, I've said, and I'll say time and time again, I feel USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee did not handle it well, and they're still not handling it well. And that's why I am speaking out about it.
I can't wrap my head around the sheer numbers involved here. That somehow, some way, that this could have ever gone on as long as it did with so many people. But the whole idea that depravity is unspeakable. It's truly unspeakable. I have not got to the point, Shira, where I'm numbed by these stories at all. Whether it's the entertainment or whether it's sports, I'm still amazed and ashamed for my gender. You know, that's there are so many perverts of this nature out there that are given free rein and taking advantage of people who just feel hemmed in. Let's face it; these young ladies live in a society, a world, a very restricted world that they want to. If they want to compete, they want to what they love to do and what they're trained to do. They have to go along with this as part of the deal. They keep their mouth shut. That disgusts me.
Well, there's so much more I would have liked to have gotten to. I mean, we didn't even get to Shalane Flanagan winning the New York City Marathon, or Serena Williams with her record-setting 23rd.
Winning while pregnant.
Exactly. Winning while 8 weeks pregnant.
No man can make that claim.
That is true. And on that note, Bob Ryan, I would like to say thank you. We'll call you the sports columnist emeritus for the Boston Globe. And you are now also host of Bob Ryan's Boston podcast and a commentator on ESPN. Thank you for coming in, Bob. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Thank you for having me. Anytime, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.